Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Professor of History at Princeton and a fellow here at the Hoover Institution, Stephen Kotkin knows more about Joseph Stalin than anyone who has ever lived. And now, part two of our interview with Stephen Kotkin on the Soviet dictator. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Lenin's Last Will and Testament. Describe what it is and why it mattered. The other fellows didn't just sit back and say, Joe, okay, fine, you got lucky, it's yours. There's months of struggle.
Well, you know, Stalin's in power, Peter. So the struggle is about removing Stalin from power. Zinoviev is not in power. Kamenev is not in power. Trotsky is not in power. Stalin is the general secretary of the party. Already in 1922-23, we have correspondence. Stalin is writing to secret police officials, and they are writing back to him in his role as general secretary of the party. He's recruiting them to his side. He's getting them to be his bagmen, to do his dirty business against potential rivals in the party. In addition, Zinoviev and Kamenev and others begin a correspondence. Geez, this is not right. Stalin is making decisions without consulting us. Stalin, behind our backs, is appointing these people and those people. Well, that was Stalin's job. He was general secretary of the party. And there's the press of events. There's all sorts of decisions that have to be made when you're the center of power. And he's making the decisions. He's, in Stalin's point of view, from his point of view, he's got the whole regime on his back. And he's working 24/7. But from their point of view, he's making decisions behind their backs without their consultation. So they begin to wonder, what could we do about this? Meanwhile, Lenin is sick. He's living in a country house in a settlement called Gorky, not Maxim Gorky. This is a different Gorky, G-O-R-K-I. Mm-hmm. It's southwest of Moscow. He's got a doctor, nurses, attendants, his wife, a longstanding wife, Krupskaya, who's also his secretary in some ways, and his unwed sister, Maria Ulyanova. This is the Lenin entourage. He's almost never in the Kremlin, never in the capital, Moscow. He's outside on this estate. The doctors think one diagnosis is it's overwork, and so therefore he should work less. So they try to reduce his workload. His mind is going. He's paralyzed. He loses the ability to write. He loses the ability to speak. The whole right side of his body is paralyzed. He tries to write a little bit left-handed. This is a guy whose collected volumes, you know, run to 55 total volumes, his collected works, not including what was suppressed, right? And now he's lost the ability to write and in some ways the ability to speak. So he's isolated. He wants to be involved in politics. The doctors say he shouldn't be. And Stalin is in charge of overseeing Lenin because Stalin's in charge of overseeing everything. And so what we see is Lenin thinks he might come back. He's trying to come back. The others are wondering whether he'll come back. He has further strokes until finally he's going to die in January 1924 after the fourth stroke, right? All this time, between May 1922, the first stroke, and January 1924, there's this ambiguity. Who's going to succeed Lenin? Did he appoint a successor? What would be the procedures of succession? Should there be a single successor or maybe a committee or a collegial body to take over? But remember, Stalin has the levers of power in his hand.
He's doing the job.
Right. Okay. He's enacting the role of general secretary of the party, which people appreciate because he's getting a lot done. As I show in the book, he was very adept at being general secretary of the party. He was not a genius. He was blind to many things. He made enormous numbers of mistakes. He learned on the job. But still, at dictatorship, he had an aptitude. And the others decide something should be done. Now, what happens strangely is there's a party congress without Lenin. This happens in the spring of 1923.
And the Party Congress is an annual event, biannual, how often?
Yes, it's an annual event, and it's the highest decision-making body of the party. And so the Party Congress is kind of where things get thrashed out. The Party Congress that takes place in the spring of 1923, Trotsky has his platform, Stalin has his platform. Stalin is the one who has the organizational muscle, and so Trotsky is crushed at this Party Congress. And it's clear that Stalin has the levers of power. Now, formally, he's in a triumvirate or a threesome with Zinoviev and Kamenev, but they're the ones complaining behind his back that he's exercising power without them. So the triumvirate is a little bit of a facade.
Right.
And as I say, Trotsky is crushed at this party congress. Now, all of a sudden, in May 1923, a document emerges, which is attributed to Lenin, his supposed dictation.
He's still alive at this point.
He's alive, you know, between May 22, the first stroke, and January 24. This is spring, May 1923, so a year after the first stroke. A document emerges from Lenin which says, this person's not that good and this person's not that good, has bad things to say about all potential successors, six that Lenin chose to name, supposedly in this document. But Trotsky comes out better than the others in the document. And Lenin's wife, Nadezhda Krupskaya, hands the document to Zinoviev in May 1923. They've known each other for a long time because they were in Zurich together in the European emigration before 1917, and Krupskaya was very friendly with Zinoviev's wife, hands it to him. It's dated December 1922, supposed dictation by Lenin. The document comes forward and has no effect. It doesn't dislodge Stalin, it doesn't reduce his power, it doesn't affect the succession struggle whereby Stalin's in power, Zinoviev and Kamenev are in this facade threesome with Stalin, and Trotsky's out of power. Krupskaya is not necessarily on Trotsky's side. She, however, doesn't want Stalin to be the sole successor to Lenin. She's looking more for a collective, collegial body because Lenin individually is irreplaceable in her mind. The document that comes forward has no effect. And then in June 1923, a second document comes forward, also attributed to Lenin, supposedly his dictation, which is now going to become so-called Lenin's testament that you were referring to. And this document is allegedly dictated in January 1923. That's the date that Krupskaya has given it, which means that in May 1923, when she handed the first document over, the second document supposedly existed already.
Already existed.
But she didn't hand it in together. But the first one failed. And then she hands in a second one, and the second one says, remove Stalin. So here it is, a little more than a year since Lenin has created the position of General Secretary of the Party. And now Lenin is allegedly calling for Stalin's removal from General Secretary of the Party. It's a sensational document. It's amazing that something like this comes forward because Stalin's ability to remain in power against Lenin's wishes would be very dubious because Lenin is the acknowledged, still alive and the acknowledged leader.
This is published in Pravda. How do people find out about it?
The document is handed or shown, we're not sure, once again by Krupskaya to Zinoviev. And Zinoviev is on holiday in Kislovodsk, a southern resort town that has mineral water baths, Kislyavadi, acidic waters, Kislovodsk. And he goes up in a cave up there on the mountainside with somebody named Bukharin and two others to talk about what to do. Here's a dictation attributed to Lenin calling for Stalin's removal. Now, Zinoviev is a very ambitious guy, Peter. He's forced Stalin to give him the job of giving the political report at the just-concluded party congress, which Lenin had always given. And Stalin acceded and allowed Zinoviev that high-profile spotlight of giving the report that Lenin usually gave. So you can't say Zinoviev's not ambitious for himself. But instead of saying, okay, let's call a meeting immediately in Moscow and let's enact Lenin's wishes, let us remove Stalin. Zinoviev concocts this crazy scheme of implanting himself and one other person in the secretariat of the party alongside Stalin, because Zinoviev has figured out that that's where the power is. And he writes a letter back to Stalin in Moscow. Oh, there's a letter from Lenin about the general secretary position. And this is what we propose. And Stalin says, there's what? There's a letter from Lenin? Now, let's backtrack a tiny bit here. Let's talk about Lenin and Gorky at the estate. We have the doctor's journals recording his activities, or actually his inactivities, his inability to write, his inability to speak, his massive headaches, just debilitated situation. We have other documents at the time testifying also to Lenin's difficulties. But now somehow we have dictation coming from him calling for Stalin's removal. It's very suspicious. We don't know in the end if Lenin dictated these documents or not. We don't know if his wife interpolated his thoughts.
What's your nobody's looked at it more closely than you.
Well, there is no document. This is the problem. You go to the archives in Moscow and you say, can I read the Testament of Lenin? And you'll get a typescript. Now, in all other matters of dictation, there's a stenographic handwritten document.
Right.
Because if somebody's speaking and you're the secretary, you're writing down not every word, but abbreviations, initials, and then you go back to your office, you go back to the typewriter, and you type it up, and then you show it to the boss, and the boss initials it, even if the boss can only initial it left-handed, because his right hand is paralyzed. But we don't have a document. There is no original stenographic account of Lenin's, quote, dictation. Now, there are other documents around this time that are Lenin's dictation with the handwritten stenographic version. This one, no. All we've got is a typescript. Moreover, the content of the typescript is changing over time. There's going to be a different version in 1923 compared to 1922. There's going to be a different version later in 1923. There's going to be a different version published in 1927. It first becomes Lenin's testament when it's circulated underground by the Trotskyites, who get called to account for circulating the document, which they've affixed the title Lenin's Testament to. And there's a hearing, Felix Dzerzhinsky, the head of the secret police, which says you're not allowed to circulate this document. And that's another version of the document that we have, the Trotskyite one that circulated. So we don't have the original. We have suspicious circumstances of its emergence. We have the convenient fact for Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, and Krupskaya that it calls for Stalin's removal. But once again, Zinoviev has not enacted the removal. He's concocted a different version, implant himself next to Stalin in the secretariat. Now, think about this, Peter. If Stalin was a maniac, if he was a sociopath, if he was dangerous and a murderer, and you had a document from Lenin calling for his removal, just for self-preservation, you would say, let's get this done. Let's remove this guy.
Right.
Let alone what your personal ambition might be to replace him. You want to save the revolution. You want to save yourself physically. Zinoviev writes to Kamenev, who's back in Moscow, working with Stalin, while Zinoviev is in this resort,
right,
this mineral water town, Kislovodsk. And Kamenev says, now this is a guy, Kamenev, who's known Stalin for 20 years at this point. Since 1903, we're in the spring, summer of 1923. He's known him for 20 years. And Kamenev is the guy who gave Stalin the copy of Machiavelli's The Prince in Russian translation. So he's not a naive person.
Right.
You can't call Kamenev naive. Kamenev says, it's not a problem. We don't have to remove Stalin. We don't have to put anybody else in the secretariat. Kamenev nixes the Zinoviev idea, which is a reaction to the Lenin document.
So from the moment Lenin makes him general secretary, there's never really a serious, he never teeters on the verge of falling out of power.
If these guys had followed Lenin's supposed wishes, if they had taken that dictation, gone to Moscow, called a meeting, held up the paper, and taken a vote, Stalin was out. But they decided not to. And Kamenev is the critical figure here. Because, once again, people talk about how Stalin's a sociopath.
Right.
And I follow only in real time,
right,
what they said about him. And if he was a sociopath, Kamenev would have known. Because he had known him 20 years.
Either we kill him now or we go to Switzerland.
Right.
Those are the two choices if you're dealing with a dangerous man.
Right. But instead, Kamenev takes Stalin's side and blocks Zinoviev's maneuver, and the testament from Lenin is not enacted in the spring, summer of 1923, but it doesn't go away.
Within the scope of this book, 1928, do we know that Stalin is a killer? Volume 2, we deal with the purges of the 30s. We deal with the effects of his decision to,
yes,
collectivize the farm. We deal with the famine.
Yes.
We know in Volume 2 that he's a killer. Do we know by the end of Volume 1 that he's a killer?
We're beginning to see, and by I say we, I'm talking about those who are around him working most closely with him, his closest colleagues. We begin to see in 1927, 1928, that the malevolence is manifesting itself.
All right.
But we only catch glimpses of this. We don't see the full version of it. And they themselves are not sure, is this really who Stalin is, or is this just a mood he's going through, a phase he's going through that will pass?
So you have, in this book, by the time this book ends in 1928, Stalin has been for some years the undisputed ruler of the Soviet
yes.
Union, and he has not achieved that position by wiping out his enemies. That will follow. But he becomes ruler of the Soviet Union through sheer cunning and force
he's
of personality,
recruiting,
hard work, intelligence,
yes,
right?
He's recruiting people to his side, he's building institutions, and he's building loyalists throughout the institutions.
Now, you gave a lecture last winter in which you said, and I was sitting in the back of the room taking notes, so this is a direct quotation, the old way of thinking is that Stalin did what he did to consolidate his power. No, I'm quoting you. He did what he did because he was a communist.
Yes.
Explain.
So what's the big story of the secret archives? What's the big story from all those classified documents that were hidden from us all those years, which in the past 20 years, especially the past 15, have been revealed? And the big secret is, behind closed doors, they spoke the same language, they said the same things, as they said in their propaganda. People thought, oh, you know, when we read the secret documents, we're finally going to get the story. No more nonsense about the working class and the bourgeoisie and the imperialists, and they're going to talk what they really, we can relax now. We're off camera, we're behind the scenes, all that crap about the proletariat, the hell with that.
We're a traditional great power, how do we, right.
Right, but instead, behind closed scenes, here they are, talking about the proletariat, the kulaks, the imperialists, the bourgeoisie, all the Marxian categories. Because it turns out that the communists were communists. They believed in the ideas. And it's only by taking the ideas and the politics seriously can you understand the phenomenon. Now, some people during the Cold War understood this. Robert Conquist, here at the Hoover Institution, for example, fully understood that these people were communists. But even smart people, the minority, who understood that the ideas and the communism mattered, nonetheless thought that Stalin's primary motivation was personal power. But he had the personal power already, Peter. That's one of the things the book shows, I hope meticulously, with the original documents. From this period of spring 1922, when he's appointed General Secretary, through January 1928, when he takes a trip to Siberia and announces that he has to collectivize agriculture, during that period of 5.5 years, he has accumulated an incredible amount of power. He's built this dictatorship inside the dictatorship, as you said, through hard work, cunning, intelligence, and also because he stands for something. People perceive him to stand for the values that they had fought the revolution for. He's their guy.
To use Margaret Thatcher's phrase, he was a conviction politician.
Yes, he was, and people appreciate that. I mean, obviously, he's a very different politician from Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher, a different outlook on the world and a different political system she's operating in. But yes, Margaret Thatcher was a woman of convictions. And that's one of the reasons she was a great politician.
So, Stephen, this is television, alas. I would love to have you to myself for the next 5 hours. You free for the next
that's
5 hours this afternoon?
That's very kind.
So, a few closing questions here. I'm doing a little bit of a dirty trick because I'm about to give you a couple of quotations that anticipate a later volume of this, but this has just puzzled me for years. Two quotations here. Here's Winston Churchill writing to his wife from Moscow in 1944. Quote, "I have had very nice talks with the old bear," which was his term for Stalin. "I like him the more I see him," close quote. Harry Truman, writing to his wife from Potsdam in the summer of 1945, quote, "I like Stalin. He's straightforward," close quote. Winston Churchill and Harry Truman are two of the shrewdest judges of character the 20th century produced, and they liked Stalin. You've now spent a big part of your life in the company of Joseph Stalin. Do you feel the appeal? Do you find yourself liking the guy?
Well, Peter, he was a charismatic figure, especially in a closed-door setting, in a one-on-one or a small, narrow group, right? Look at the photograph on the cover of the book. This is an unretouched photograph from 1927. Very few photographs of Stalin are unretouched. Usually, they dress him up. And in fact, in removing the pockmarks and other marks on his face, you lose the charisma of the eyes, the glance, right, the brain that you can see there. Here, I believe, in this photograph, you can see some of that, and that's what people also saw when they were in closed, very close quarters with him. He definitely could charm people. He could charm all sorts of political figures who were very shrewd. This didn't mean that he didn't have another side to him, a vicious side, a malevolent side, a cunning side that some interlocutors did manage to see when meeting with him, and some didn't manage to see. But Stalin also often kept his word in these negotiations. If he promised to do something to another world leader, he would often enact that promise. Now, he wouldn't promise things he didn't want to do. So there were many things he kept quiet about.
After Yalta, Churchill goes back and stands up in the House of Commons and says, I think I can quote it exactly, "I know of no government that keeps to its word better than the Soviet government." An amazing statement.
Yes, unfortunately, that's a false statement, obviously, and he was misled in that regard, or he was trying to get something done in a political sense where he needed to say things.
You want Greece, I think, but that
he needed to say things that others would go along with him. In the end, you know, I don't really like Stalin. He's not a figure that you come to like. When you see what his power did, the consequences of his rule, the millions of people enslaved, deported, executed, died on behalf of a crazy lunatic ideology, the people he tortured, not personally, but the ones that he ordered to be tortured, and the ones that he tortured psychologically, and that's personal. The more you know about him, the more impossible it is to ever like him, to ever feel the humanity of him in some human way. But I'll tell you something, he's awesome. Nobody accumulated more power than Stalin. Nobody exercised more power than Stalin. So from a purely political standpoint, from the standpoint of dictatorship, he's the gold standard. Not in the moral sense, obviously, but in the pure power sense, it's breathtaking. And so there's an awe-inspiring quality to him at the same time as there's deep revulsion about how we use the power.
Last couple of questions, Stephen. Here's one of them. Reagan very famously in 1983 referred to the Soviet Union as an evil empire and said we were caught up in, quote, a struggle between right and wrong and good and evil. Right, wrong, good, evil, to a professional politician, are these categories even legitimate? Is it possible to understand Stalin in the whole without them?
Once you accept the premises of the regime, once you accept the premises of the Marxism, once you accept the premises of the ideology, Stalin was true to the ideals. The problem is I don't accept those premises. I don't accept Marxism. I don't accept communist ideology. And so therefore, what Stalin did was criminal. It was evil. There's no doubt about it. But evil is more interesting the more human it becomes, the more contextual it becomes, the more part of the sweep of Russian history it becomes. Evil becomes more understandable when it's actually bigger than a single person in addition to being that single person. So even if you reject the communist ideology as I do, understanding it and taken seriously is a part of understanding Stalin's criminality and his evil. You know, the Cold War was about something real. It was not a misunderstanding. We have this crazy notion that if they just talked more, if they just got together more, if they just could understand each other better, that there wouldn't have been a Cold War, or we could have avoided the Cold War. It's bunk. The Cold War was to contain the Soviet menace, and the Soviet Union was a menace not only to its neighbors, but to its own people. The Cold War was necessary, and in that sense, Reagan was right. And so speaking about criminality and evil is certainly possible in the political realm.
Do you know that I almost weep for relief to hear a tenured professor at Princeton University say such things, Stephen?
Well,
did you overlap with George Kennan at all?
Truth is a powerful argument. That's all I've got to say.
Here's my last question. Again, I'm going to quote Stalin. Stalin, Volume 1. And would you please hurry up and finish the next two? Stalin, Volume 1. I'm quoting you. Actually, I'm quoting a quotation within you. You start by quoting a historian yourself. More than almost any other great man in history, wrote the historian E.H. Carr, Stalin illustrates the thesis that circumstances make the man, not the man the circumstances, close quote. And then Stephen Kotkin writes, utterly, eternally wrong.
Unfortunately, you know, Carr was a great historian. He did a lot of work. He's still very influential to this day. He trained several students who are very prominent. But he got a couple of things wrong. He apologized for Stalin, and he appeased Hitler in editorial newspaper, unsigned newspaper editorials. It's hard to get both of those things wrong, but he managed to get both of those things wrong. But with Stalin, he never really got to the bottom of Stalin. And he made Stalin, like Trotsky did the same thing, out to be a representative of something else rather than an individual actor on his own terms. Ironically, Stalin will do the same with Hitler. Stalin misunderstands Hitler to a certain extent as a representative of the capitalist system in decline, of finance capital. Stalin fails to appreciate that Hitler is an individual actor who can create his own circumstances the same way that Stalin was able to do, as I show in Volume 2.
I just said that was the last question, but here's the last question. I am really puzzled about your standing within your profession as a professional historian. You just said the Soviet Union was a menace, the Cold War was necessary, the idea that we misunderstood them is bunk, that was your term, bunk. And here you have just said, men make history. And of course, that runs against an enormous amount of work by historians in the mid to late 20th century saying, whoa, the great man idea of history, please, let's all calm down. There are large historical forces at work in which we're all caught up, and we are, if not corks on the ocean, we're more affected by events than we affect them. Great man, please. And Stephen Kotkin comes along and says, oh, yeah? Read this. Look what he did.
Yes.
How do your colleagues look upon you?
Well, I do political history. Political history is not so much in vogue. Cultural history is pretty much the predominant practice in the academy today. Social history was the predominant practice in the 70s and 80s and still survives to a very great extent, but cultural history has really taken over. But I do political history, I do diplomatic history, I do geopolitics, I do power. This is the thing, the structuralists are not wrong. You know, history is a landscape. It's a landscape of possibilities and limitations. Once you sketch in the structures, the big landscape, the world prices for grain, the size of somebody's army, the geography in which they're located, the nature of their neighbors, the political institution. You sketch in all the various different structures, and then you have the historical landscape of possibilities and limitations. It's on that historical landscape that people act or don't act. That's how we begin to understand historical agency, in that big structural landscape. But the structural landscape doesn't move itself. It has to be moved by agency. It has to be moved by actors, sometimes small people, sometimes great people. And so what you see with Stalin is an ability to shift the structural landscape, to find levers onto socioeconomic engineering and geopolitics that very few other people are going to find. And we have to explain that, and we have to show the consequences of that.
Stephen, you old-fashioned man, you believe in free will.
Yes, I do.
You believe it illuminates the whole drama, or it drives the whole drama?
I believe it's very important. You're absolutely right. Yes.
Stephen Kotkin of Princeton University and the Hoover Institution and the author of this magnificent book, Stalin, Paradoxes of Power, 1878 to 1928, Volume 1. Will you please hurry up with Volumes 2 and 3? Thank you. For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.